From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Time magazine food critic Mimi Sheridan. Her commentary assesses not only the taste of food, but what that food says about our times and culture. Also on today's show, I talk with rock musician Brian Ferry. The founder, lead singer, and songwriter for the former British band Roxy Music has a new solo album. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings of Gershwin musicals on the 50th anniversary of the composer's death. And Ken Tucker reviews enduring and unendurable Christmas home videos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When Mimi Sheridan was a child, one of her favorite dishes was her mother's chicken a la king. Since then, she has dined at many of the finest restaurants in the world. Over one 11th-month period, she tasted everything in the Bloomingdale's food department, 1,961 items, the subject of one of her best-known articles. Mimi Sheridan is one of the most influential food writers in America. She wrote about food for New York Magazine for 5 years. From 1976 to 83, she was the food and restaurant critic for the New York Times. Her verdicts were reputed to have the power to make or break new restaurants. Since 1984, Sheridan has been Time Magazine's food critic, which has enabled her to broaden her focus to national and international eating trends. But she continues to cover the New York restaurant scene in her new subscription-only newsletter, Mimi Sheridan's Taste. I spoke to her from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked Sheridan how she thought restaurant reviewing has changed since she started writing.
Well, I don't know that reviewing itself has changed. Restaurants have changed a great deal, and the fact that there is so much competition between restaurants, and because the restaurant scene has become such a hot one, I think that the field of restaurant critics has grown enormously because there's much more to write about. I think if there is a noticeable change in reviewing itself, it is perhaps that reviews are much longer than they were, say, 10 or 15 years ago. There's more to talk about. Restaurants have become a form of theater. The setting is extremely important. The tone of the clientele is very important to some readers. They want to know what the scene is going to be when they get there. So there are more details. Also, people have become so interested in food that I think reviewers have to tell them more about it and go more times to a restaurant before they can write a review, and that in itself makes the reviews longer. So I do think that restaurant reviewing has, in a way, created a market for the restaurants. It's kind of goes in circles. The restaurants are there, the reviewers write about them, people want to go, more restaurants open. But I do believe that without restaurant criticism and critics and their little feuds, fewer people would go to restaurants. Many restaurants say they wish there were no critics. They wish people could just come in and make up their own mind. But if all restaurant criticism stopped, let's say in a city like New York for 3 months, I think 100 restaurants would go out of business.
When you're reviewing a restaurant, what's your method of ordering so that you can really judge how the food is prepared?
Well, usually we're four people. My husband and I usually go first to see if it's going to be worth reviewing. But then it's usually four people. And I ask people to order what I want to see. And as the visits progress, the choices narrow. But what I try for is an across-the-board sampling of the menu. I want to see, obviously, different foods, how they do veal and chicken and fish and beef, but I also want to see how they fry and broil and sauté and poach. I want to see, if they have them, how classic dishes are rendered, and I want to know how the house creations are rendered. I like to see a restaurant at a slow meal and at a very busy meal. If there's an important lunch scene as well as dinner, I make sure that half of my visits are at lunch and the other half at dinner. I never review in fewer than three visits and rarely in fewer than four or five.
You are always very careful about protecting your identity. I mean, that's one of the things that is legendary about you. You're never photographed with your face shown. How have you managed to keep your identity as protected as it's been? Though, to tell you the truth, I imagine a lot of New York restaurants really do know who you are.
Indeed, they do. I would say about half of the places I go to in New York know who I am. Mm-hmm. I can still get into 50% of them without them knowing. But the other truth of that is that the 50% who know me are 100% of the fashionable places where I would least like to be known. I mean, they're most tuned into it, and I've been doing this for a long time, so waiters move around from job to job, and a waiter might recognize me if it's an owner who hasn't been on the scene before. But beyond that, outside of New York, I have never been recognized in a restaurant except maybe by a diner who knows me, a friend. So I have absolutely no problem outside of New York. And, of course, in my work for Time magazine or my newsletter or Condé Nast Traveler or any of the other places I write for, I do a lot of work outside of New York and outside of the United States. So I have no problem there. What I do in New York, the places that really know me will no longer be fooled by a wig and glasses, which is what I used to do. Because they know my husband, because they know what the rest of me looks like, even without my head. So that doesn't work. But I never make a reservation in my own name, ever. If it's a place that I know will know me, we always eat with two other people that the restaurant will not know, and they arrive first to see if they get the table we requested when making the reservation. I usually say, you know, put us in the back or put us in the front, or could we have a round table instead of a banquette? So we see if that's honored. If not, we ask the people who are going to be there first, our friends, to ask for that kind of table. If they're not given it, then they just take what they get. Now and then they try to tip to see if that will get them a table. And I must say that rarely works.
Oh, do you hope that it won't work? Would that be a sign of corruption if tipping got them a better table?
I don't care. I mean, if you say, do I hope? I mean, I don't really want a restaurant to do the wrong thing.
But is the wrong thing to accept the tip and show you the better table?
Indeed it is.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. It's called selling tables in the restaurant business, and it's supposed to be a no-no in a place that has a really good management. They would not go for that. It's a crummy kind of thing to do.
Can I interrupt here and ask you what kind of wigs you used to wear?
Well, I have a whole wardrobe. There was one that was sort of henna, a long page boy with bangs, which I called my 30s Greenwich Village Lady Poet wig. I had a very pale, silvery blonde bouffant that came down over one eye, which I called my Five Towns wig, which are the five towns out in Nassau County.
In Long Island.
Yes. And I had a very curly sort of, not quite black hair, because that would have looked very strange with my skin, but quite dark, that I really didn't have a name for. And those are the three I used a great deal of the time. I still take them sometimes for certain out-of-town places where a few customers might know me. In Washington, D.C., and Chicago, I often take the wigs.
My guest is Mimi Sheridan. She's a food writer, formerly with the New York Times, now with Time magazine. She also publishes her own new food newsletter, which is titled Mimi Sheridan's Taste. Now, in your newsletter, you recently described one Italian restaurant as having an atmosphere that is gloomy, dated, and suggestive of an old age home. That's a pretty negative thing to say.
It was a pretty negative place.
I'm going to read something else you said that is also equally scary for a restaurant. You described another restaurant's special white room as a blazing dining room that suggests a high-toned interrogation center. Now, if I were that restaurant, I would not be pleased.
Well, I'm not in the business of pleasing restaurants.
Were you ever threatened by a restaurant owner?
Never really flatly. There was one restaurant that got a very bad review, and it was a very famous restaurant for a long time, used to be very good, and they got a very bad review in my early days of reviewing at the New York Times, and they did say, if you know what's good for you, you will never come in here again. But that's the closest that anyone has ever threatened me.
Anybody ever sued you or threatened to?
A couple of times, yes. There was once papers were actually served, but nothing ever came of it. And a couple of times restaurants have threatened to, but never did it.
I guess that would be a very bad precedent for food writers if you could get sued for saying bad things
about
a restaurant.
You can get sued, and in fact, Galt Millot, the French critics, were not only sued, but they lost a judgment that was later reversed. Mr. Chow sued them for $20,000 in damages and won, but that was overturned in an appeal. You can be sued, indeed, and I think one of the things that has protected me is that anyone who sues me for what I have written in the New York Times or Time Magazine takes on the New York Times and Time Magazine and are probably reluctant to do so. And for the newsletter, I indeed will have libel insurance.
Well, you are very controversial because your opinions are so clearly stated. If you are recognized in a restaurant, in spite of the wig you might be wearing, in spite of your efforts to remain anonymous, are you ever asked to leave?
I have been refused service once and asked to leave once, and did so in both cases, although I have a number of lawyers now who feel that a restaurant's case would not hold up. There was an old interpretation of what's called the innkeeper's law that stated that a hotel or restaurant owner had the right to refuse service to anyone he or she wanted to, as long as it was not on grounds of race, religion, sex. And so when I was always prepared for that happening, and I asked the lawyers at the Times what they wanted me to do, and they said, just go. And it happened at the Water Club on the East River. I had had one meal there when they didn't recognize me, and then I sat down. We were six people, and someone came over and said that they had reason to believe there was a critic at the table, and they wouldn't serve us. So we left. And then another restaurant refused me a table when I got there with a reservation that someone else had made. However, there are, as I say now, I've been hearing from a lot of lawyers, even some up at the Cornell Hotel School, who feel they would love to fight that case because they don't think that that would stand up. I avoid it unless too many places do it, because it will be a Pyrrhic victory. My picture, you know, if it got to be a really talked about case and my picture were in all the papers and so on, it would defeat something else that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, one more thing about anonymity. Now, your secret's safe with me about what you look like, because after all, I'm speaking to you from Philadelphia. You're in New York. We're speaking via satellite, and I can't really see what you look like. However, the engineer who's recording your interview in New York right now might have a Polaroid camera. I mean, does this ever happen that someone takes a shot of you and tries to mail it to a major American publication to blow your cover?
In the first place, how do you know I'm really Mimi Sheraton? I may have sent someone out.
Uh-huh.
If no one knows, I can. But there are pictures around, and I think that anyone who wants one has one.
Mimi Sheraton is my guest. She's one of America's best-known food writers. She used to review restaurants and write about food for the New York Times. Now she freelances and is the food critic for Time Magazine. She also has her own newsletter, which is titled Mimi Sheraton's Taste and is available through subscription. We'll talk more about food after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Food writer Mimi Sheraton is my guest. I think perhaps one of the worst hazards of the trade a food writer faces is overeating. You're forced to have rich meals and many of them. And I know that you had taken a 5-month leave from the New York Times when you were still working with them to lose weight. Is this really difficult to deal with when you're writing about food?
It's very difficult to deal with, but in truth, I would have to say that I probably have pursued this career as an excuse to overeat, I think that the people who are really good at it are all in that position. You love to eat, and therefore this gives you a reason to do so and an excuse to do so. But I do try, I mean, even though I am very much overweight, I try not to have it get any worse than it is by compensating when I'm not reviewing. That's the trick, and that's also a very hard part because I love to cook. So if it's a night when I'm not going to a restaurant and I'm going to prepare dinner at home, I have that awful tug as to whether to make a simple piece of steamed fish or whether to make a marvelous bowl of pasta with, you know, something wonderful on it. And so it is a struggle. I try to swim, I try to walk, I try to take periods off when I don't have to eat. And my husband and I, when we are going on a real vacation, we try to find a place that is warm, that has very interesting things to see, and that has terrible food. And we have found a few countries that fulfill that. Egypt, Greece. There are a few others where if you eat simple fish and vegetable, that's going to be the best thing that'll happen to you. But the ruins are wonderful. The climate is superb. The markets are glorious. Because if we go someplace that has wonderful food and food shops, we will spend all of our time in it. And that's what I do all year long.
When you started writing for Time magazine, you said that you were especially interested in institutional food, where the eaters are a somewhat captive audience. Why are you interested in that?
Because it's becoming an increasingly important part of eating in the United States, and because I think that that food is much worse than it has to be. It's school eating, it's employee cafeteria eating, it's hospitals, it's airlines, it's executive dining rooms, and it's pretty soon going to be about a third of the eating that most Americans do. And I feel the psychology and economy behind it are necessitating a kind of bad food that could be improved.
Now, you've said that the only real dismal failure of your career was when you were a consultant for 1 year to a university hospital trying to improve patient food there.
Yes.
What happened? This is interesting because of your interest in institutional food. Apparently, you tried to make it better in one instance and couldn't do it.
That's what got me interested in institutional food, because it's the hierarchy, the bureaucracy you have to work with, the remoteness of the people who are going to eat the food from the people who are preparing it. And because of the attitudes developed by the people who prepare the food in enormous quantities, it suddenly becomes something else. The thing that defeated me there was very much the bureaucracy, the unions, the inability to get people to change their ways when you weren't there. My only solution was really to shoot the first person who deviated from a recipe. and I felt then we'd have no trouble with anybody else. But, of course, they would have gone on strike if we had done that.
You would have lost your job anyways.
Yes.
Now, you, as part of your survey of institutional food, you did one piece in which you flew all the different airlines and compared the meals that you were served on the planes.
There was one particular leg of a United Airlines flight that had superb food, because I think it prepared the kind of food that could be done well within those circumstances.
It struck me as a very extravagant trip to make, to buy all these airline tickets just to taste the food, though maybe you had other reasons for traveling, too.
I didn't buy the ticket. Condé Nast bought the ticket
right.
as a story that would get a lot of attention. And it certainly did, and it was very important to do. And en route, I did four other stories for them, so it wasn't quite as extravagant as it looked.
You have to go to restaurants all the time, both in New York and around the country. What are some of the new trends in restaurants that you're seeing now?
Well, one of the most interesting is the new fashionableness of Italian restaurants. At the moment, it is outstatusing French food, especially in the kind of elegantly casual cafe trattorias that have been opening on New York's Upper East Side, around Chicago, and in Los Angeles. There is something about Italian food that lends itself to current ideas of good nutrition, to grazing. Its appeal is a little more accessible than the French. And just as the Italian fashion designers a few years back sort of stole the show from the French, I think the Italian chefs are now doing that. Not in the upper reaches of haute cuisine, but certainly in what is fashionable and trendy. I think in probably the second most important trend is the French bistro return, which is not unlike the Italian in its appeal. And I think we'll be seeing smaller restaurants instead of the very big ones that have been created in the recent past.
One of the things I've been noticing is that some of the restaurant bars that obviously catered to professionals in their 20s and 30s are now becoming family restaurants with high chairs and accommodations for children, children's menus.
Well, I guess the young people are having children and want to go back.
Well, precisely.
I must say I have not noticed that in the really fashionable ones in New York, simply because they're usually too expensive.
Right.
But I think that we'll see a new kind of market in the year ahead because of the stock market and so on.
What is your native food? What was the food that you were brought up on?
Well, I was brought up in Brooklyn in a Jewish family that was not kosher. And my mother made what is considered Jewish food, but she made a lot of what is American food and what certainly was at the period, the sort of Fanny Farmer school of cooking, fried oysters, clam chowder, chicken pie, and traditional American food. I did write about it in a book called From My Mother's Kitchen, and it is all of the food that I grew up on. But my parents loved to eat in restaurants, and we did go to what we called the city, meaning Manhattan, quite often to eat, and there were a few good restaurants, especially seafood in Brooklyn at that time, and we ate a lot of Chinese food. So we were always aware of all of that, and my father was in the food business. He was in the wholesale fruit and produce business in Washington Market, and my mother was a good cook, so there was always talk of food at the table and in the family.
You had a very nice piece in the book about your mother's cooking, a piece on comfort cures and the kinds of food that your mother used to make for you when you were sick and home from school back
yes.
when you were a child.
Yes. I still make them for myself.
Do you? What are they? What are the foods?
Well, there were things like, as one was getting better, there would be eggnogs, there would be cinnamon toast, there would be baked custard with nutmeg on top, inevitably chicken soup, but I also liked things like oatmeal, and I made a lot of those for my son when he was young, and they still seem to work.
How much do you eat out now?
I would say almost every night. We eat home on the average now about 1.5 times a week, and I eat a couple of lunches a week out.
Do you find that you behave differently or even chew differently when you're eating out than you do when you're at home?
I think I spend more time at the meal when I'm eating out. You know, when I left the Times, one of the things that I missed was cooking at home, and my husband and I said, now we're going to be able to eat at home. And so the first 4 nights, I cooked dinner at home. And the 4th night, we just looked at each other across the table and said, this is boring. The food was fine, but there was no scene, there was no one else to look at, and the meal is over so quickly when you eat at home compared to when you eat in a restaurant. So I don't think I chew differently. We probably eat more when we eat at home because we can have seconds.
Right. I don't know if you're the kind of person who has to finish everything that's on the plate. Like whatever the portion is, small or large, that's what you're going
to
eat?
Well, I try very hard not to. I almost always do finish. However, the one course that I find I can taste and leave is dessert. I'm not a dessert person. So I can take a couple of bites of a dessert and leave it. But I don't think that I can practice what I call pasta interruptus. I think that would not work.
Do you have any guilty pleasures in food, foods that aren't especially well-prepared or even especially good for you that you really crave and love?
Do you mean junk food or do you mean food that isn't good for me? I mean, I like everything that isn't good for me, and I eat it because I'm fortunately quite healthy, and I don't have cholesterol or high blood pressure problems. But there is no junk food that I crave. I would not say that. I mean, I like good potato chips. I like good peanut butter. I like well-made pizza, but I don't consider that junk food. I don't like Twinkies, and I don't like frozen anything. So I don't really feel guilty, except for eating too much.
One of the things you mentioned that you're doing for Time magazine is writing about food and restaurants in different cities, cities beyond New York. When you're going to a city that you've never been before, how do you figure out what's the right place to eat? What's the most interesting restaurant in town?
Well, I keep very good files on what's happening in many of the main cities. I subscribe to all of the city and regional magazines, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, South Florida, New England Monthly. So I keep a very good file of what is new and what is being talked about. And I do things like asking a cab driver who is Hungarian or something if he knows a good Hungarian restaurant. I have found a lot of interesting places that way.
You know, before we were talking about trends, new trends in restaurants, and you mentioned that Italian restaurants are very in now. What's one of the silliest, most pointless trends in food that you're seeing now?
Well, I've always thought one of the silliest is what's called California cuisine. I think that whole standard picture of the swordfish with the grid marks and a few undercooked baby vegetables rolling around on the plate had nothing at all to do with cooking. That's a matter of food arranging, of no cooking, and I don't think that is something to be taken seriously. I think we get silly trends like blackened redfish at a time when many people are talking about keeping fish natural and simple and not obscuring its flavor. One of the most popular dishes, blackened redfish, totally obliterates its flavor and dries out the fish. So, I mean, there's a lot of that going on, but maybe it always has.
Christmas and New Year's is one of the biggest food seasons for most civilians, but you're a professional when it comes to food. Is it a big food season, bigger than any other for you?
I would say any other than Thanksgiving, and that's only one day. So yes, it is the biggest season. We will be doing a family dinner Christmas Eve, just my husband, son, and I. We are having about 10 guests for Christmas dinner. Then the three of us are going to have a brunch on the 26th before we go off to see a matinee of Traviata. And then I'm having an open house on New Year's Day, which is going to be something I traditionally do, a huge Scandinavian buffet. I love Scandinavian food, and it lends itself to that season. And it looks festive, and it's a sort of all-out bash.
Sounds just like my schedule. Mimi Sheridan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been food writer Mimi Sheridan. Her cookbook, Visions of Sugar Plums, has just been published in paperback, and her annual guide to New York restaurants is about to have a new edition. She started her own newsletter, which is titled Mimi Sheridan's Taste, and the former New York Times restaurant critic is now writing about food for Time magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Father Michael Doyle. He's the priest at the Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey, which is an economically depressed area. Father Doyle is a deeply religious man who over the years has had serious differences with the church hierarchy. His church is committed to social change, helping the poor and the homeless. I hope you can join us.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with singer and songwriter Brian Ferry. In the mid-70s, he founded the influential art rock band Roxy Music. Ferry has a new solo album. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the satirical Gershwin musicals Let Him Eat Cake and Of Thee I Sing. And Ken Tucker looks at home videos for Christmas, from It's a Wonderful Life to Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. A hijacking drama is being played out in Rome today. A teenager said to be 15 years old is holding six crew members of a KLM Dutch jetliner at Leonardo da Vinci Airport. Italy's interior minister said 91 passengers were released unharmed. However, Reuters is reporting that some passengers may still be on board. Italian authorities say the hijacker claims to have a time bomb and threatens to blow up the plane unless he receives $1 million ransom and another plane. Officials describe the teenager as a Dutch citizen of Italian origin. Police and anti-terrorist officials reportedly are talking with the hijacker from the air control tower, and police have surrounded the plane. Today, the White House revised its forecast for the economy in 1988. It is now predicting slower growth, but not a recession. Beryl Sprinkle, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, said he expects new jobs to be created next year.
Something on the order of another 1.5 million new jobs on average for the year, with the unemployment rate averaging less next year than this year, but staying very close to present levels, that is 5.8%.
Sprinkle said both short-term and long-term interest rates are likely to fall next year and that there will be slower consumer price inflation. The Soviet Union has announced that its troops are involved in a major new offensive in Afghanistan. This is a rare admission for the Soviets, who don't usually talk at all about their involvement in Afghanistan. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Spokesman Gennady Gerasimov said Soviet troops are supporting the new offensive in the 8-year-old Afghan war. The attack began Monday after rebel forces ignored a government demand that they withdraw from a road leading into the town. An estimated 8,000 Afghan troops and several hundred Soviet advisors are stranded in the town. Khost is surrounded by rebel-held territory and in recent weeks has been supplied by airlift. Gerasimov said rebel casualties already total about 1,500. He said he did not have casualty figures for Afghan and Soviet troops. Western analysts estimate there are 115,000 Soviet troops in Afghanistan. But throughout its 8-year intervention in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union has never reported casualty figures. This is Ann Cooper in Moscow.
President Reagan taped a holiday message to the Soviet Union today. It will be played on Soviet television on New Year's Day. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev is expected to make a similar tape, and the major U.S. television networks have been asked to air it at the same time President Reagan's message is being aired in the Soviet Union. But the U.S. networks have not said yet whether they will air Gorbachev's message. A Christmas message has been sent to U.S. hostages in Lebanon. In a letter published in two Beirut newspapers today, family members assured their relatives they are not forgotten. The families also had a message for the pro-Iranian factions believed to be holding the captured Americans.
To the captors, we ask that in the spirit of the Christmas season, that their hearts would soften and let these men free. And in our own small way, begin a peace process that will benefit both the hostages and their families and the people of Lebanon.
Peggy Say is the sister of hostage Terry Anderson, the Associated Press correspondent missing since March 1985. She spoke from her home in Batavia, New York. This will be Anderson's third Christmas in captivity. He is one of 8 Americans missing in Lebanon. Stock prices jumped over the 2000 level today for the first time in almost 2 months. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 27 points to 2,005.64. Volume was heavy. 203 million shares changed hands. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 41 cents. I'm Mara Liasson. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Early this year at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, Michael Tilson Thomas conducted the Orchestra of St. Luke's, the New York Choral Artists, and a few stars in concert versions of two Gershwin musicals. In their original productions, one was a flop and the other a hit. A live recording of the Tilson Thomas performances has just been released on CBS. Our classical music critic Lord Schwartz says the musical that flopped in 1933 might actually be the bigger hit today.
Maybe the best George Gershwin recordings to be released this year, the 50th anniversary of his death, are the reconstructions of the two satirical musicals he wrote with his brother Ira in the early 30s, Of Thee I Sing and Let 'Em Eat Cake. Of Thee I Sing was a big hit, the longest-running book musical of the entire decade. It had three hit tunes, the title song, Love is Sweeping the Country, and Who Cares? It was even the first musical comedy to win a Pulitzer Prize. Let 'Em Eat Cake is a sequel with many of the same characters, but it's much darker in tone, and it was a flop. These recordings, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas and starring Maureen McGovern, a rather charmless Larry Kurt, and the irresistible Jack Gilford as Vice President Throttlebottom, mark the first attempt to record complete, or almost complete, stylistically authentic Gershwin musicals. Most of the original orchestrations for Of Thee I Sing were lost in a storeroom until 1984. Let 'Em Eat Cake required more extensive restoration, since none of the original orchestrations have ever been found. Of Thee I Sing satirizes American presidential elections. John P. Wintergreen gets elected by running on a platform of love, and nearly gets impeached because he marries the wrong, but really, of course, the right, First Lady. His political skin is saved when his wife announces her impending motherhood in a song called Posterity is Just Around the Corner.
Why, posterity is just around the corner. Posterity is just around the corner.
Posterity is just around the corner.
It really doesn't pay to be a mourner.
Posterity is just around the corner.
Posterity is here, I don't mean maybe.
There's lovely guarantees and I'm a baby.
Posterity is here and will continue.
We really didn't know we had it in you. Posterity.
The musical numbers mix a Gilbert and Sullivan lunacy, like the political satire of the Marx Brothers in Duck Soup 2 years later, with pure Broadway. The title song catches some of that cheeky spirit, especially in the little phrase that comes at the end of the recurrent fanfare. Of Thee I Sing, baby. Let 'Em Eat Cake, 2 years deeper into the Depression, adds a new ingredient, the threepenny cynicism of Kurt Weill. In the late 20s and early 30s, political satire in the form of musical comedy was an international phenomenon. We shouldn't forget how much Weill owed to Gershwin. Today, at least on these recordings, Let 'Em Eat Cake is the more exhilarating and daring score. It bursts out of the musical comedy mold that Of Thee I Sing was only beginning to push against. The plot deals with the revolutionary overthrow of the American government by the Blue Shirts. Ira Gershwin called it a satire on practically everything. Even the one love song that became a standard, Mine, concerns the self-centeredness of the romantic couple. Here's David Garrison as Kruger the Revolutionary, expressing some of the negativism that probably cost Let 'Em Eat Cake its audience in 1933.
Down with one and one make two, down with everything in view, down with all majorities, likewise all minorities, down with you and you and you.
Down with one and two, make three. Down with all of us as he.
Somehow I abominate everything you nominate. That's the torch we're going to get the flame from. If you don't like it, why don't you go back where you came from?
If you don't like it, why don't you go back where you came from? If you don't like it, why don't you go back where you came from?
Let's tear down the House of Morgan.
House of Morgan.
Let's burn up the Roxy Organ.
Roxy Organ.
Down with Curry and McCooey.
And McCooey.
Down with Chow Mein and Chop Suey.
And Chop Suey.
Down with music by Stravinsky.
By Stravinsky.
Down with shows except by Minsky. Happiness will fill our cup. Let's down with everything that's up.
Let's down with everything that's up.
Down with books by Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky.
Down with Boris Tomaszewski.
Tomaszewski.
Down with Balzac. Down with Zola.
Down with Zola.
Down with pianists who play Nola. Down with all the upper classes.
Upper classes.
Might as well include the masses. Happiness will fill our cup when it's down with everything that's up.
When it's down with everything that's up.
So down with this and down with that and down with everything in you. The hell with this, the hell with that, the hell with you and you and you.
The hell with who?
The hell with you.
The hell with who?
The hell with you.
The hell with you and you and you and you.
Ira Gershwin's reference to Boris Tomaszewski, the founder of the Yiddish theater in America, is especially pointed here. Tomaszewski was conductor Michael Tilson Thomas's grandfather.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a recording of Michael Tilson Thomas conducting two Gershwin musicals, Of Thee I Sing and Let Him Eat Cake.
Comes a revolution, everything is Jake. Comes the revolution, we'll be...
This is Fresh Air. My guest is British singer and songwriter Brian Ferry, the founder of the group Roxy Music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has described Ferry as an archly romantic songwriter who sings in a bored, aristocratic crooning style. Ferry formed Roxy Music in the early 70s. In the early years of the group, he was joined by Brian Eno, one of the first rock musicians to experiment with synthesizers and other forms of new technology. Roxy Music broke up in the early 80s. Ferry recently released his seventh solo album, Bête Noire. Brian Ferry grew up in a coal mining town in northern England. He studied painting and ceramics at art school, then moved to London in 1968. That's when music took over his life.
After I graduated and moved to London, that's when I started to learn a bit of piano, and I started writing my own songs, and then it started to feel as if I was really creating something, you know. And those songs became the first Roxy album.
Well, when you put together Roxy Music, you were, what, about 25 years old?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually pretty old for someone to put together
oh,
the
yes.
first band.
Yeah, right. So I think I had a lot of kind of music in me by then. So the first few years, I did a lot of records. It was all stored up, as it were.
What was the sound you had in your mind when you put together Roxy Music?
I don't know. It was to try and do something which didn't sound like what other people did. It was one of the ideas. I was influenced by so many different kinds of music, not only black American music, which was probably my main source of inspiration, but, you know, Indian music, Arab music, all kinds of ethnic things as well. And having been to art school, I'd been kind of familiar with art music, people like John Cage and Morton Feldman, this kind of thing. So it was kind of... We were interested in kind of experimental sounds. You know, we had a synthesizer, which was quite rare at that time. And so we used to treat the instruments to try and make them sound a little bit different and so on. And even the voice sometimes. So it was always an adventure. Each thing was, it was really exciting, you know, because there was, we didn't feel there was anything else that sounded like that.
Still basically an amateur when you put together Roxy Music.
Still am.
Well, did you feel like you operated on guts a lot of the time?
Oh, yeah, because we didn't feel particularly skilled, but the attitude was strong. And it was kind of, even though it was kind of arty music, as it were, it was very emotional. And we felt our hearts were in the right place.
You started performing in tuxedos and elegant jackets. Did that image for you come from movies or from other music groups?
Came out of desperation.
What do you mean?
Well, no, the first year or two, we kind of wore pretty outlandish costume. We thought, well, let's make this a bit of a theatrical experience. So we would kind of, nobody was really doing that at that point. So we felt that was an interesting thing to do. And after a year or two of kind of, you know, the sort of rather strange costumes we wore, it seemed a natural thing to do something a bit different and into suits and a more kind of anonymous look, you know. It seemed to be a strange juxtaposition of images or something. And it seemed to capture people's imagination, perhaps too much, in fact.
You mean because it drew attention away from the music itself?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. You know, you always have to be aware of that. Because sometimes an image, if it's too strong, can get out of hand.
One of the first records that you recorded was an album of pop and rock standards called These Foolish Things. And what you recorded on it ranged from Leslie Gore's It's My Party to Bob Dylan's It's a Hard Rain Gonna Fall and the standard These Foolish Things.
Yeah.
And you sang them with a lot of irony. Mm-hmm. And I thought that irony was partly your attitude toward the songs, but also your attitude toward yourself, because you didn't think of yourself as fitting the image of the people who'd sing those songs.
Right, yes. It was after the second album. And it was great fun to do. We did it in about 3 weeks, which was very quick for me. And I particularly like the title track, These Foolish Things. I like to do songs from that period where perhaps you're dealing with a song rather than a great recording, you know, because that song's been done so many times that you never think of one specific recording of it.
The smile of Garbo and the scent of roses, the waiter's whistling as the last bar closes. The song that Crosby sings, These Foolish Things, remind me of you.
What were the things that you felt that you lost and that you gained when Roxy Music broke up and you went your own way as a solo artist?
I think it's just that you get a bit tired of being tied to the same people as if by a piece of rope, you know, and you think, well, does it have to be like this for the rest of my career or whatever? And there are certain things that you miss from making group recordings, the kind of the shared responsibility, say, you miss a bit, and the kind of the mass hysteria and sort of enthusiasm that you get from working with, you know, other people who are sharing a project can be very strong.
One of the songs on your new record is called Kiss and Tell.
Oh, yeah.
And the opening of the lyric is 10 cents a dance, it's the only price to pay.
Oh, yeah.
Why give them more when it's only love for sale? Is that a bit of an homage to the songs 10 cents a dance and love for sale?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. I like to make references to old songs sometimes. You know, I like songs from, like period songs, I suppose, from the period when they were well crafted and written by songwriting teams sometimes, you know.
Earlier on, we established that when you started to perform and you were still really an amateur, you felt like you were performing a lot on guts.
Yeah.
And you implied that you still feel that way?
Well, I think you're always learning. I think it's a very healthy attitude to have. Nowadays, I kind of play with some of the best musicians in the world. I'm very lucky to know a lot of really good players, and I learn from them all the time, I think. Especially since the last two albums, say, or last three albums, were kind of difficult to make and took a long time. So I felt, and they were pretty complex, you know, because there are a lot of musicians on there, a lot of parts. They're quite complex. Hopefully, I could imagine the next album being a bit simpler than the things I've been doing. I feel I've kind of done what I had set out to do a little bit, you know.
By simpler, you mean less highly produced?
Yes, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, just a kazoo and a and a pair of tap dancing shoes.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Ferry's new album is called Bete Noir. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following the White House's revision of its economic forecast for 1988. They now say that the gross national product will go up by 2.5% or so. That's a good deal less than what they'd said earlier. Also, a report on a convent in Texas where nuns raise miniature horses. And backstage with the Boston Ballet, they produce the most seen version of the Nutcracker every Christmas, and we see how they do it.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. By now, you may be tired of all of television's Christmas offerings, but you still may be in the Christmas spirit. Our critic Ken Tucker has some video alternatives.
As if you didn't get enough Christmas programming on regular television, you can now rent or buy a whole slew of holiday video cassettes. At least with cassettes, you can choose the time of day or night you'd like to watch this relentlessly cheery stuff, and you don't have to suffer through the colorized version of, say, It's a Wonderful Life if you don't want to. That Frank Capra classic starring James Stewart as the small-town man whose life passes before his eyes one Christmas Eve is in fact one of the less chipper holiday movies, a masterpiece of emotional manipulation. Compare this to a more shameless tearjerker, Miracle on 34th Street, the 1947 film with Edmund Gwenn as a real-life Kris Kringle. The classic Christmas musical is, of course, White Christmas. This film is stuffed with Irving Berlin standards and stars Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye as a couple of song and dance men entertaining the troops during World War II. The jokes are pretty cornball, but who cares when you've got Der Bingle singing not only White Christmas, but also crooning Count My Blessings to an insomniac Rosemary Clooney.
When I'm worried and I can't sleep, I count my blessings instead of sheep. And I fall asleep counting my blessings. When my bankroll is getting small, I think of when I had none at all. And I fall asleep counting my blessings. I think about a nursery and I picture curly heads. And one by one I count them as they slumber in their bed.
A less familiar holiday movie recently released on video cassette is Christmas in July, starring Dick Powell and Ellen Drew. But more significantly, it was written and directed by Preston Sturges in 1940. It's the movie that began Sturges's string of madcap, witty, non-Christmas comedies like The Lady Eve and The Palm Beach Story. Other offbeat Christmas cassettes include Santa Claus, the Movie, a 1985 bomb featuring Dudley Moore as one of Santa's elves, A Christmas Story, humorous Gene Shepard's rather cynical 1983 Christmas fable, and Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, a 1964 grade Z flick teeming with low-budget special effects and an apple-cheek little girl who would grow up, but only a few inches more, to be Pia Zadora.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear snow.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Robert Brustein. For the past 30 years, he's helped shape American theater as both a critic and a producer. He founded the Repertory Theaters at Yale and Harvard, and he reviews theater for the New Republic. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will continue his review of new recordings with a Christmas theme. His survey begins with the punk band The Ramones and ends with Prince. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Ironweed, adapted from the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by William Kennedy. It stars Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, and Carol Baker. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.